Well, well, well. Good afternoon to you. Here we are, Wednesday. And we like Wednesday. We've got a guest joining us. I want to play you a little something that got me excited about this woman, Amy Scherer. It's from this little bit of sound that I might have played for you the other day.
My name is Amy Scherer, and I'm the Senior Legal Policy Analyst at the Heritage Foundation's EdMeese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies. Just as doctors can only recommend an effective treatment plan if they first form a correct diagnosis based on accurate assessment of the symptoms, policy analysts and policy makers must have an accurate understanding of the societal problems they are seeking to combat.
I love this. I love that because they pay no attention to what they're supposedly trying to combat. Amy Scherer, welcome to WTIC. Thank you for being here.
Todd, thank you so much for having me.
That was so much fun because they ignore cause and effect in their policy suggestions. They look at symptoms. They don't look for causes. Why were you talking about causes? Why are you trying to mess up their game there?
Well, so I would like to think that I'm talking about causes because, you know, as a citizen of the United States, I have a vested interest in making sure that, you know, if we're going to do things like, you know, try to combat gun violence, try to lower rates of people who are dying unnecessarily, that we should actually, you know, try to do things that are going to effectively, you know, accomplish that goal, preferably without infringing on the Second Amendment. So I kind of see that really as my job, and I wish that politicians who are, you know, trying to enact public policies would do a better job of understanding their jobs.
So what do they understand? What's your, since you walk into the swamp, you're right there in the mire, you're testifying to them, you're having these conversations, what's your perception of where government is at? Because I feel like we're at a new place in American history in which the disconnect from actual pursuit of good policy seems to be 100%. Like, that's not even a goal, good policy. Am I being too cynical? What's your perception?
Well, look, I don't want to paint all politicians or all, you know, all gun control advocates with a broad brush, because I do think, you know, at the end of the day, everyone, there's not like two sides of this issue where, you know, one half of America is pro-gun violence and the other half of America is anti-gun violence. I think we all want the same thing, which is safer communities, you know, safer individuals, you know, safer families. But what often gets in the way is politics and sort of how we go about accomplishing that. And I think this really came across if you have the time to watch all 5 hours of this hearing, which frankly felt like 5 hours of a cage match. You know, it was a lot of just sort of political grandstanding, of really not trying to understand the issues, but of having sort of a preconceived notion of what the issue is, and then saying, okay, we're going to do X, Y, and Z because it's good, you know, it's good politics.
You mean like the talking points in the gun debate? Like,
right,
we have to
right.
get rid of certain weapons that fall under a name, and that name doesn't mean anything about what the actual weapons are.
Exactly, and I think part of this is that, you know, gun violence, a lot of these issues, they're complex issues, but when you give people, you know, sort of an easy, simple solution to it, to say, oh, it is, you know, this scary-looking assault weapon that, you know, you think is scary-looking. You know, that's the issue. I think it's easier from a political standpoint to sort of convince people that the issue is the simple, easy solution, you know, that we can, you know, somehow magically enact. You know, we can somehow make all these guns just disappear. And so I think that's really one of the big problems you're seeing is, you know, it's just easier to tell people, oh, you know, we came up with this solution and now we're going to do it, even if that easy, simple to grasp solution has nothing to do with the actual problem.
All right. So this is what I meant when you said before, you don't want to cast aspersions on everybody because there are some good people there. To me, we've got the point that I'm describing where I think we've gotten is that it, of course there are good people, and of course there are a few bad people, and there's everything in between. But what really dictates is where the system is at. What are the incentives? What are the imperatives that people respond to once they get inside the system? And those imperatives seem to have gotten so strong that even the wisest, most thoughtful people, if they're part of that system and the political process, they get sucked into it. And it becomes this cheerleading black-white, left-right session that you describe.
Yeah, you know, and it is hard sort of when there is this ongoing narrative from one side that says, you know, that the problem is these scary looking guns, or, you know, the problem is mass shootings, which are, you know, statistically, they're terrifying, but they are statistically a fraction of a percent of all gun deaths every year. They're not a major part of the problem. You know, that there is just sort of this narrative, and it's hard for people, even when they want to enact real change, you know, they actually do want to solve real problems. It's hard for them to, you know, effectively combat that narrative and say, okay, well, I get this is sort of the big talking points, but, you know, can we look at some real problems? It's hard to do that from a political perspective.
Right, right. So then you get trapped into the world of confining yourself, not really saying what needs to be said and what people need to understand, because you don't have enough seconds to establish the meaning that you need to establish to convince people of the facts they need to know so they can come to the conclusions that you've come to. So what is that answer? Where is the reality of the gun debate? In what ways are we being forced into a deceptive discussion that isn't actually talking about the real things?
Well, I think one of the first things people have to recognize is that when you're hearing these terms about, you know, we're in a mass shooting epidemic, yeah, gun violence epidemic, that this is a crisis, that this is actually objectively untrue. So when you look at rates of gun crime, you know, gun violence, we're actually in one of the safest times in American history. So the height of sort of gun crime, gun violence was the early 1990s.
And what you're talking about all gun violence. So this would include urban crime,
right.
and everything.
This would include gun homicides. This would include non-fatal firearm crimes. We've actually seen a dramatic drop-off. So our gun homicide rate is about half of what it was in the early 1990s. Non-fatal firearm crimes, so, you know, if crimes where no one is killed, but it's still a gun crime, are about one-sixth of what it was in the 90s. So there are major aspects of gun violence that are actually getting a lot better. What we're actually seeing is this problem with an increase in gun suicides, which is this whole sort of different context of mental health.
That's a big chunk of what's going on, right?
Right. No, absolutely. But the thing is, they're fundamentally different from a public policy perspective. You know, I think, you know, people have this understanding of, you know, gun violence. What we're really dealing with is this giant epidemic of mass shootings, which isn't really the case.
Let's talk about that. Let's talk about what are the things that are going up in this overall downward phase that we're in. We're talking with Amy Swearer from the Heritage Foundation. You know, what is there a problem with, whatever the proper term is, with these shootings that they show on TV that they use to get everyone fired up that we need gun control, the school shootings or whatever, the mass shootings that happen in the suburbs, I guess, as opposed to the mass shootings that happen in the cities?
Sure. So when you're talking about this concept of mass public shootings, you are seeing there over the last decade or so, there's been a slight increase in terms of, you know, how often they're happening. But to put that in context, we're still talking about a fraction of a percent of all gun deaths every year. And so it's, you know, again, I fully understand that this is something that terrifies people, because it's that notion of, you know, I'm just going to go to Walmart and someone's going to shoot me. And it sort of puts crime in a very random context that it normally isn't in.
Yes, but how much are those types of shootings over, say, 3 years? Are we in the middle of some big spike, even if the total numbers are small as a percentage of overall shootings?
No.
Is this one category skyrocketing?
No, it's not skyrocketing in the sense of, you know, we've never had a slight rise in rates of these mass public shootings before. You know, so this is not something, you know, where it's rising to this sort of crisis epidemic type of thing. Though, I mean, again, it is fair to say there has been a slight rise in rates of mass public shootings. And I think what you're actually seeing is the way that, you know, that the mass media, the sort of access to media 24/7, it makes it seem sometimes like this is, you know, some sort of grotesque, out of the ordinary thing.
Because those videos are so outrageous and compelling.
Right,
when you see
them. Because we have constant access to it.
Yes.
In a way that we didn't necessarily have in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. So I think, you know, our perceptions of how big of a problem this is have changed. But I don't think it's consistent with what we're actually seeing is just a slight rise in a very, very small part of the problem.
All right, Amy, hold on one sec. We've got to take a quick break and then we'll continue. Amy Swearer is here from the Heritage Foundation. Stay with us on WTIC. WTIC. Yes, indeed. We're talking with Amy Swer from the Heritage Foundation. So, Amy, just the slight uptick in these shootings that we see on TV all the time, is that like from, you know, 3 a year to 4 a year? From what percentage kind of increase are we talking about?
So it sounds like a big percentage increase, because when you're talking about things, you know, going from, say, like 3 or 4 a year to more like 6 or 7, you know, to I think this year. And again, it depends on how you're defining it as well.
Well, that's so a good point, too.
Right. So that's why you'll see some people, it's happened with school shootings as well. You know, you'll see some people who will say, oh, we've had, you know, 127 this year. And you'll have other people be like, it's more like we've had about, you know, averaging about a dozen per year.
Yeah, some people include when the school security guard accidentally discharges
right.
his weapon when nobody's around.
And I think actually, you know, I'm glad you're bringing up sort of in a school shooting context, because I think it's important for parents to understand. We have had, you know, recently, I think when you look at sort of 2013 with Sandy Hook and 2018, we've had a couple years that were sort of just completely abnormal in terms of numbers of deaths. But really, across the board, you look at sort of what happened last year. We're back down to, well, actually below average for what you know would... I don't want to say expect in a given year, but we've been averaging about 10 student deaths by guns on campus at all, you know, 100,000 K-12 schools with something like 30 million K-12 students, which mm-hmm. is 10 too many. I think we all would agree on that. But to say that this is some sort of crisis, when actually that's a much lower number than what we, again, saw in the 1990s. You know, so this is something where, just like all violent crime trends, there have been spikes in school shootings. You saw this at the end of the 1990s, where people forget we had a school shooting commission over some of the stuff that was happening in the 1990s. I think really at the end of the day, what this comes down to is figuring out, how do we hit at some of the root causes of these problems? You know, so
well, I agree with you on that, but yeah. I wanted to put it in context first, just because I feel that the context is so distorted by the media coverage that you mentioned. But go ahead, move on with where you want to go, because that's interesting.
Yeah, so I think at the end of the day, what this really comes down to is figuring out, one, you know, is this sort of some epidemic that necessitates, you know, drastic action, you know, confiscation of millions of weapons, and two, would that even be effective? And so this is what's actually frustrating, is that, you know, you'll see things like with mass shootings, which, you know, we agree that these are devastating incidents. But then to sit there and say, okay, well, our policy solution is that no one gets to have an AR-15. Well, you look at that and you say, well, is that really going to fix the problem? And the answer is no, because it turns out that people who are bent on mass public violence have many readily available means at their disposal. They're actually not statistically using AR-15s. The weapon of choice for these shooters is actually handguns. That's especially true when we're talking about school shooters. You know, so,
really? Handguns are used more often.
So when you look at the statistics on this, something like 5 or 6 in 10 of these mass public shooters use handguns alone. And then when you look at some of the ones that, when you break it down into who used rifles, a lot of times when they're using rifles, they're also then bringing a number of other weapons with them. So it's actually only about 2 in 10 times that they're using rifles alone. And so a lot of times what you actually see is that it wouldn't have mattered necessarily whether they had a rifle or the handgun. What actually mattered was the amount of time they had to walk around and shoot people mm-hmm. who were unprotected. That the bigger factor was sort of how quickly did law enforcement, you know, or some sort of armed civilian get there and confront that shooter. That is actually the problem we're seeing, not the type of handgun, or excuse me, the type of firearm used, but how long that person had. Because again, you know, when you have someone who's bent on violence, it doesn't necessarily matter
sure.
which type of deadly weapon they have. That's why you have mass stabbings in China, where dozens of school children are being stabbed to death by mentally unstable people. And it really, again, it has to do with pinpointing and intervening with people who are bent on that violence, whether it's before, you know, preferably before they're ever harming people, or getting there as soon as you can once they are in the process of harming people.
So what you're describing is that as a public, our perception of what's actually happening with these shootings is totally distorted. And we have
Absolutely.
No idea how infinitesimal this is in the world of gun deaths in America?
And I know it sounds callous to say that, because clearly for individuals who are you know, in entire communities that are reeling from this, you know, that the statistical anomaly, it to them doesn't matter, nor should it. I don't think we should expect that to matter to the to people who are grieving. But from a public policy perspective, we need to understand sort of, you know, this isn't some massive, you know, all-consuming problem that necessitates, again, disarming millions of law-abiding citizens. And also, even if we did think it was this massive problem, would disarming people who were never going to commit violent crimes stop people who are bent on violence?
All right, well,
roundly is no.
That's a really good way of looking at it. Okay, we've got about 2 minutes left, or minute and a half left. What else can you tell us that is really important for us to know?
I think one of the biggest things is to look for areas where we actually all agree that there can be some work done. And I bring that up to say, when you look at sort of the scope of gun violence, 2/3 of gun deaths every year are suicides. And that's something that's actually increasing. And then when you're also talking about mass public shooters, a lot of these guys are mentally unstable. They've had clear signs of being mentally unstable for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what this points us to is that a large proportion of these, you know, incidences of gun violence, whether it's suicides or mass public shootings, are inherently a mental health issue, that there is a lot of room for us to work together across both sides of the aisle, because we agree, you know, if we can get to some of these underlying issues, you know, preventing suicides, preventing people who are unstable from getting their access to firearms, you're treating people before they become violent, that these are avenues we can all agree to work on, and they don't affect the rights of people who aren't violent, who aren't mentally unstable, who are never going to use their firearms in an inappropriate manner. And so I think that's the more effective, healthy solution, is, again, to look at some of these larger systemic underlying problems.
All right, what's that percentage of mental health involvement with did you say mass shootings? Is that what you offered for a stat?
Yeah, so mass public shooters, it's, again, it's a small portion of the actual problem.
Mm-hmm.
But so you have about 25% of these guys who had a diagnosed mental illness.
Okay.
And then, you know, somewhere between 50% to 65% who had clear signs. They may not have been diagnosed, because it's hard to, you know, diagnose people after the fact, but they were showing clear signs of mental instability that would indicate to a lot of people, you know, either they should have been diagnosed or they were reaching, you know, sort of that mental health crisis where they would have been diagnosed in the near future.
All right, Amy, thank you so much for your time. It's great to talk with you. Amy Swearer, Heritage Foundation. Is there somewhere online people should go to read more at Heritage?
Well, you can certainly always follow me on Twitter at Amy Swearer, or if you go to @heritage.org, you can find a lot of our research and writings and op-eds on a lot of these issues.
Okay, Amy, thank you so much. Great to talk with you.
Thank you.
Wow, so that's really interesting.